Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for up to half the cost. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Savings based on cost of Consumer Cellular single line 1, 5, and 10 gig data plans with unlimited talk and text compared to lowest cost single line postpaid unlimited talk, text, and data plans offered by T-Mobile and Verizon January 2024.
Tonight on The Readout.
Many people have asked me what my position is on abortion and abortion rights, especially since I was proudly the person responsible for the ending of something that all legal scholars, both sides, wanted and, in fact, demanded be ended. Roe v. Wade.
That's a lie, of course. Only the extreme religious right wanted to take away a woman's right to control her own reproductive choices. But Trump wants to have it both ways on abortion, trying to hang on to some women voters while not angering his evangelical base. Senator Elizabeth Warren joins me to discuss that, as well as President Biden's new student debt forgiveness plan and how Russian propaganda is seeping into the rhetoric of congressional Republicans. Happy Eclipse Day to all of those who were lucky enough to be in the path. Let's hope that the majority of you didn't stare directly into the flaming ball of plasma like your former president, who seemed to think that the laws of science did not apply to him. April 8th is not just Eclipse Day. It also happens to be the day 50 years ago that Hank Aaron broke Babe Ruth's all-time home run record by slamming home his 715th. With a simple swing of his bat, Aaron beat back streams of racist death threats and taunts to become one of the greatest players in baseball history. Today is also a good reminder that there are great marvels and great men in the world. And then there is Donald Trump, who paused his God complex and endless comparisons to Jesus, Alexei Navalny, and Abraham Lincoln to compare himself to another man far greater than him, Nelson Mandela. Over the weekend, Trump once again claimed victimhood. He did so while again attacking Judge Juan Marchand, who is overseeing the hush money election interference trial that's set to start next week. Trump posted the following on his scam website, Truth Social, quote, "If this partisan hack wants to put me in the clink for speaking the open and obvious truth, I will gladly become a modern day Nelson Mandela. It will be my great honor." Well, before I go any further, it might be helpful for us and for Trump specifically to remember who exactly Nelson Mandela was and what he did for his country and the world. Unlike Donald Trump, Nelson Mandela was a man of great humility, decency, and courage. And while he was born into actual African royalty, Mandela remained a man of modest means who slept on mats and used his elbows for pillows. His father did not give him great wealth. What he did give him was his hand-me-down clothing. It was in the late 1940s when the Afrikaner Nationalist Party won the whites-only general election and began implementing apartheid across South Africa that Mandela's path would change. It was then that he decided that he would dedicate his life to opposing apartheid legislation, which subjugated South Africa's black majority. His fight for freedom from oppression made him a target by white Afrikaners. The fight against apartheid escalated over the next decade, leading to the 1960 Sharpeville massacre, in which white police fired into a crowd of peaceful protesters, killing 69 people. That led Mandela and other African leaders to mount general strikes and protests, which led to more escalation and a ban, not just on strikes and protests, but on Mandela's African National Congress itself. In 1964, Mandela received a life sentence, not for trying to overturn an election, but for protesting the fact that Africans, who were 80% of the population in an African country, were not allowed to participate in them. He narrowly escaped the death penalty on charges that included treason, and he spent 27 years in prison, hidden from the world, because his calls for equality were deemed a threat to white supremacy, including in the United States, where Mandela was labeled a terrorist by the Reagan administration. He was released from prison in 1990 to become the country's first black president. But before he was sentenced, Mandela recited the following from memory. During my lifetime, I have dedicated myself to the struggle of the African people. I have fought against white domination, and I have fought against black domination. I have cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an ideal which I hope to live for and to achieve. But if needs be, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die. Up until 2008, the United States continued to officially deem Nelson Mandela a terrorist, with the State and Defense Departments declaring the African National Congress to be a terrorist group. Mandela's name remained on the U.S. terrorism watch list, even after he was sworn in as president. Donald Trump is no Nelson Mandela. In fact, Trump is currently leading a party that has declared that white people are the real victims of racism and that black and brown people are dirty animals from S-hole countries who deserve to be placed in internment camps or shot either at the border or at protests for daring to ask for what Nelson Mandela was asking for, justice and equality. This weekend, Trump kept up his racist diatribe while speaking to a gathering of uber-wealthy Republican donors and defending his previous comments that people from African countries like Haiti and South Africa are S-hole countries. He reportedly defended those comments by saying, why can't we allow people to come in from nice countries, you know, like Denmark, Switzerland? Do we have any people coming in from Denmark? How about Switzerland? How about Norway? Countries that just so happen to be overwhelmingly white. What do these millionaires get in exchange for Trump's blatant racism, xenophobia, criminality, and violence? Well, a promise to extend their tax cuts, which are set to expire in 2025. What do those people give up for Trump's promise to maintain their precious tax cuts, aside from their dignity and their morality? Well, just a little over $500,000 each in donations to his campaign. And boy, was his campaign eager to crow about it. Lara Trump, the daughter-in-law, gloated that they doubled the amount that the Biden-Harris campaign raised just 2 weeks ago. Well, the Biden campaign and Democrats did indeed raise $26 million in a single night last week, using a diversity of high-wattage celebrities and former presidents Clinton and Obama. The money they raised came from 5,000 people who paid anywhere from $225 to $500,000. Leaving the Biden campaign with far more cash on hand than the Trump campaign, which the Biden-Harris campaign is using on television ads and for opening field offices in key states around the country. Meanwhile, the Trump campaign will be spending a significant portion of their fundraising haul from, what, 100 and some odd people on Trump's legal defense fund, which includes more pathetically desperate attempts to delay next week's trial. Today, he tried to postpone the trial while arguing to move the venue, a motion that was denied. He's also suing to have Judge Juan Marchand removed from the case and to have the gag order lifted. We also learned what else Trump's crony friends have given him. And according to the Daily Beast, it's apparently a dubious $175 million bond that doesn't actually promise that it will even pay the money if the former president loses his $464 million fraud case on appeal. Again, that man is no Mandela. Joining me now is Reverend Al Sharpton, president of the National Action Network and host of Politics Nation on MSNBC. David Jolly, MSNBC political analyst and former Republican congressman who's no longer affiliated with the party. And Catherine Christian, MSNBC legal analyst and former Manhattan assistant district attorney. Thank you both, all three, for being here. Reverend Sharpton, Big Brother Rev, please, I'm going to just let you have the floor to comment on Donald Trump having the raw nerve to compare himself to a man that you actually got a chance to know, Nelson Mandela.
Well, it is atrocious. First of all, Nelson Mandela went to jail trying to fight to get people of color, black people in South Africa, the right to vote in their own land. Donald Trump is facing charges, particularly in Georgia, of trying to deny those that had voted in the election there and try to disenfranchise them by trying to get votes that allegedly never happened. I was an election observer in 1994 in South Africa, and I could not imagine Nelson Mandela who I did get to speak with and know when my visits there and his visits here. I couldn't imagine him calling saying, I need 11,000 more votes out of Durban. Can you help me? I need some more votes out of Cape Town. To try and belittle a man who literally changed the democracy as we now witness in South Africa to a man who tried to undermine a democracy is to desecrate the whole movement of democracy around the world. Even for Donald Trump, this is lower than anything I could have imagined to compare himself to someone who is not only unlike him, but fought for the exact opposite of what he has demonstrated in his own maneuvers to undermine black voters and, for that matter, under voters to the point where he's under indictment for doing something. Nelson Mandela became inducted in a Global Hall of Fame of freedom fighters. Donald Trump has been indicted in four different federal districts among the charges trying to undermine people's right to vote or the value of those that did vote.
Yeah, I mean, David Jolly, it feels to me like there is this sort of movement on the MAGA right to take all of the iconic movements for black liberation and flip them and, you know, sort of conscript them in what Donald Trump is losing, which is a movement for white domination. To compare yourself to Mandela is real ironic when the Sharpeville massacre was white police shooting at black peaceful demonstrators, when Donald Trump has said American police should do the same to black demonstrators. When Nelson Mandela, as Reverend Sharpton has said, was fighting to get the 80% majority black population the right to vote when only the 15% white voters in that country were allowed to vote. Donald Trump is doing the opposite. All of his election denial was about places where black and brown people live and saying those people's votes were inherently illegitimate. And he's his former guy, Stephen Miller, literally made a fake civil rights organization that's suing to stop black people from getting everything from grants to jobs to even grants to each other and saying that only white people should get anything economically in this country. This is the new Republican Party, though, David. They are literally leading a white nationalist movement grafted onto the Republican Party. Your thoughts?
Yeah, it's a cult parked inside a political party. And I don't think there's much more to add to what Rev said other than amen. I mean, in Nelson Mandela, you have someone working for the equality of all people, willing to give his own life. And Donald Trump, you have someone trying to interrupt equality for all people. And Joy, last week we were laughing at that Donald Trump was jealous of Jesus Christ. This week he's jealous of Nelson Mandela. I would say the Prophet Muhammad and Gandhi are next, except Donald Trump probably doesn't appreciate their heritage. So he may not go there. I would say this. I mean, you're exactly right about the state of today's Republican Party and Trumpism. I mean, they are elevating someone who is racist, misogynist, xenophobic, and bigoted. Those are Mitt Romney's words. And in elevating him, they are sleepwalking towards a dictatorship. And those are Liz Cheney's own words. And you see in Romney and Cheney and others, people who have stepped aside from mainstream MAGA Republicanism because they see in Donald Trump exactly who you and the Rev have articulated. You know, we fall short in seeing this as merely an election. This is a transitional moment in November for the country if we elevate someone who is racist, misogynistic, xenophobic, bigoted, who wants to return to a dictatorship. That is the question for the American people in November.
Yeah, and Catherine, he's not even honest about like the easy to Google thing. I mean, literally, thank goodness that Letitia James called him on his BS. The $175 million, everybody's like, well, okay, at least he came up with it. After they reduced it, Catherine, they gave him a break. And he comes forward with some guy who says he's going to give him a bond. No, he didn't. The little-known insurance company that rescued Donald Trump, per the Daily Beast, by providing a last-minute $175 million bank fraud bond isn't just unlicensed in New York. It hasn't even been vetted by a voluntary state entity that would verify that it meets the minimum eligibility standards to prove financial stability. Perhaps even more troubling, the legal document from Knight Specialty Insurance Company doesn't actually promise that it will pay the money if the former president loses his $464 million bank fraud case on appeal. Instead, it says Trump will pay, negating the whole point of an insurance company guarantee. Even the bond post, Catherine, was a fraud.
Yeah, yes. I mean, as you said, even the fact that it was not licensed into New York, you could maybe forgive. But all of the other reasons you just gave makes it a useless bond, because the whole point is that if Donald Trump loses his appeal, the attorney general wants to be able to enforce the judgment. But there's not going to be any money there because the bond does not really exist, because then it goes back to, as you said, Donald Trump. So it's interesting because a trial that involved civil fraud and found Donald Trump liable for repeatedly committing fraud, that a bond that would be put up is probably fraudulent. You can't make this up.
Reverend Sharpton, the other difference, there are so many between Nelson Mandela and Donald Trump, is that Nelson Mandela wasn't afraid to go to prison. Donald Trump clearly is. And the reason he's doing the most and now trying to sue the judge and now trying to throw all these useless appeals is he's terrified that this case is going to start next week. And he clearly doesn't have any money, which is why he put up the fake bond.
Well, he clearly is petrified of going to jail, and he's using all kinds of maneuvers to try to even avoid a trial. And the difference is, as you read at the opening, Nelson Mandela said he was proud to go to jail. He would even be willing to die for the cause. Well, what cause is Donald Trump trying to stand for? A cause of trying to defraud banks and insurance companies out of their money? A cause of trying to rob people of the right to vote and women their right to choose? I mean, what is his cause? So not only is he not like Mandela as a man, he has no mission other than his own self-aggrandizement and his own narcissism. The only thing that you can find some value in is there are some people that would not argue if he got 27 years in jail like Mandela, but it'd be for many different reasons.
I think people would be quite glad. People might clap and applaud. David Jolly, I'm going to give you the last word on this, because Donald Trump, who claims he just wants Swedish people and people from Norway in the country, he used to lie about being Swedish. He claimed in Art of the Deal that his family was Swedish and they're German. But I wanted you to just explain to me, as somebody who used to be a Republican politician, explain these people in this room. It was like 112 some odd people that each put up $500,000 to be in the room with Donald Trump and promise him money. The guy whose home it was came, I believe, from South America, what Donald Trump would consider an S-hole country. Vivek Ramaswamy, who comes from India, which Donald Trump would consider a S-hole country that they don't want people from. Where is the dignity of these people? Are they so desperate for just another bloody tax cut that they would humiliate themselves by hanging around with a guy who does Nazi talk?
Yeah, I think what we've learned is whether you have $1 billion or $10, some people are okay with autocracy and with somebody who peddles in racism and xenophobia. I mean, we know from Donald Trump that he's okay with white immigrants, but not immigrants of color. That's essentially his own words. And look, we don't know what's in someone's heart, but we know what's on their lips. And what's on Donald Trump's lips when it comes to immigration is racist and xenophobic, and we should call it as much. I would suggest what we're seeing among the donor community, again, the billionaires are the people giving $10, is a negotiation with themselves. It's a negotiation with themselves that they are okay with the cultural movement that Donald Trump has ignited, this white nationalist movement, if they are the winning side politically. From Jamie Dimon to Joe Smith, look, there's a shame that should be cast upon all of them.
I will just channel Nelson Mandela all the way to Medgar Evers and say, find out who these billionaires are that are giving to an autocrat and act accordingly with your dollars, because you can choose whether you're going to do business with them or not with your money. Reverend Al Sharpton, David Jolly, Catherine Christian, thank you all very much. Up next on The Readout, Senator Elizabeth Warren joins me to discuss President Biden's new student debt forgiveness plan, Donald Trump's latest comments on abortion, and the Kremlin's efforts to influence congressional debates. As one Republican congressman admits what we already know to be true, that some of his colleagues are repeating literal Russian propaganda. Stay right there.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need.
Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
I was doing what moms do in the kitchen with my three children, making dinner, checking emails, and I open up an email that said, "Congratulations, your loans have been forgiven." To say I was stunned, a total understatement. It was $40,000+ in student loans just gone, zero. I wish you could have seen it. There was dancing. There were tears on my part.
In the past few years, more than 4 million Americans have opened their email or student loan account to see the life-changing news that their balance is now zero, thanks to the Biden administration's student loan forgiveness plan. Well, tens of millions more of you out there could soon be getting the same good news. As today, President Biden announced a new student debt relief plan that could lower or erase the loan balance for up to 30 million Americans, which is, to borrow a Bidenism, a big effing deal. This new plan, which is expected to be rolled out in the coming months, focuses on select groups of borrowers, those who owe far more than they originally borrowed due to interest, those who have been paying for at least 20 or 25 years, those who attended career training programs that led to high debt loads or low earnings, those who are eligible for existing forgiveness programs but never applied, and those experiencing hardships that prevent them from making loan payments. And joining me now is someone who has been fighting for student loan debt forgiveness for years, Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. Okay, Senator, this is something you've been pushing for. Explain why. Let's explain the sort of ramifications of this for ordinary Americans.
So this is just a hallelujah day. This is the day when Joe Biden announced, as you said, 30 million Americans are going to see either all or a chunk of their student loan debt wiped out. And it's been a long fight to get here, but he's doing it. And, you know, I want to tell the story because I think the story says a lot about Joe Biden, says a lot about his values. So back when he was first sworn in, one of the first things he wanted to do was figure out what he could do about student loan debt. Because, as you know, this is crushing millions of Americans. 40% of the people who have student loan debt do not have a college diploma. These are people who tried and didn't make it, or they were never in a four-year program to begin with. And here they are, no college diploma, but still struggling with student loan debt. We know this falls particularly hard on African Americans. We know it falls harder on women. So we've got a lot of people who are dealing with student loan debt, really struggling with it. So President Biden announces a plan. He's going to cancel student loan debt for tens of millions of Americans. What happens? Republicans showed their values. First thing they do is they sue the president and try to shut the whole thing down. Go to Texas, get a stay. And so it all shuts down, goes all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And this extremist Supreme Court decides that the words waive or modify loan debt doesn't actually mean waive or modify, which is exactly what the president had said he was going to do. Okay, so the president knocks the Supreme Court knocks the president back. And, you know, I got to say, at that point, a lot of folks in politics would have said, "I did my part. I tried. Supreme Court told me I couldn't. I'm done." Instead, Joe Biden turned around and said, "Okay, do I have any other tools in the toolbox? Tell me what I've got and let me pick them up and start using them." And he started right away. He has already canceled student loan debt for 4 million people. And he announced today that using existing law and existing regulations, he is going to build out from that. And he's got a path to cancel debt for 30 million Americans. Yeah. This is going to be transformative for these people. And this is about showing that we can make government work, not just for billionaires, not just for giant corporations. We can actually make government work for families. That's what Joe Biden's all about.
Yeah, it's interesting because, and I actually know a family member who just over this last weekend, and I didn't know this and didn't prompt it, said, you know, that they got one of these magical emails that said $30,000 of debt that they've carried for decades because, again, it takes forever to pay it off. And this person is a working professional in the education field and said it's and said they used the words life-changing, that kind of debt. It truly is. You know, and you talked about the Supreme Court and the extremism of them because they're extreme on everything. You know, when it came to abortion, it's the same thing, right? They said, oh, sorry, ladies, you women don't have the right to control your own bodies. Donald Trump then is left in the position where his party says, goody, we're now going to do a national abortion ban in addition to the states. He now is coming out and trying to pretend that, oh, no, leave it with the states. Does anyone in the United States Senate believe that? Because it seems to me that between the Comstock Act and Lindsey Graham saying we're doing a 15-week abortion ban, it's BS when he's saying that.
Of course it is. And we all know that. You know, you really want to say to Donald Trump, how dumb do you think the rest of us are? We're not going to let him lie his way out of this. Donald Trump brags and continues to brag to this day about the fact that he put this extremist Supreme Court in place and all of these folks who stood up and so soberly said to the American people and to the United States Senate, yes, I'm going to follow precedent. And that was all supposed to be code for, I'm not going to fool around with Roe versus Wade. And then the very first opportunity they had, I don't mean the second or third, I mean the first chance they got. They said, oh, you know what? Not anymore. We're just flipping the whole thing over. And for the first time in American history, took away a constitutional right from half the population. Said, we're done. Not going to do that. And of course, we know what's grown up since then. And that is, we've got 20 states that effectively ban abortion at some level or another. But here's the deal. You can't sit there comfortably in a blue state and say, well, you know, as long as it's state by state, I'm okay. No, you're not. Lindsey Graham made clear they're coming for everybody in this country. And right now, there are Republicans putting together a whole plan through the Heritage Foundation and their other work to say, you know, even if we can't get an abortion ban through Congress, if we can just get Donald Trump in the White House, we will go ahead and ban abortion nationwide. And they're laying out what they think are the tools that they can use right now and then get their extremist courts to sign off on it. You know, this is why I keep saying, Joy, and I know you do too, abortion is on the ballot in 2024. Mm-hmm. And this is the strongest contrast between Donald Trump, who put this extreme court in place, who helped overturn Roe versus Wade, and Joe Biden and the Democrats who say, you put us in, you give us the White House, the Senate, and the House, and we're going to make Roe versus Wade the law of the land.
And by the way, those of who live in Maryland, if y'all think Larry Hogan is going to protect you from that, know that he will vote for it. He's going to vote for that, too. If you're in Maryland and thinking, oh, I liked him, he seemed moderate, then none of them are moderate on this issue. Last question here. I have to point out one of your fellow senators, J.D. Vance. He made some a pretty dumb. I'll just say it was an interesting statement. I won't characterize it any other way, that he was slamming the fact that he said undocumented immigrants got some of the jobs that caused the low unemployment rate. Isn't it the case that when job growth improves, that means that the people who are picking the lettuce and picking the strawberries and picking the fields to make sure that people have food also get jobs? And the people who are doing the chicken plucking plant, the dangerous work where their fingers get chopped off, some of those people are undocumented. Is it a bad thing that they're doing those jobs, or in your mind, a good thing?
You know, look, I want everyone to have work permits. So if they're here and they're here on parole or however it is they're here, they need those work permits. And the reason they need it is so they don't get exploited in the work that they do. But let's be clear. Immigrants in the United States boost our economy. They make our economy work better and faster. They are out there in a country where we have a significant portion of people who have retired or who are about to retire, who are not in the workforce. Immigrants are much more likely to be in the workforce. They pay taxes and they help support Social Security. You want the economy to work? then we need to get those immigrants work permits and have them out there working.
Like like the show Hamilton said, immigrants, they get the job done. Senator Elizabeth Warren, thank you very much.
You
and
bet.
The squad, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, all pushed for that policy on student loans, and Biden did it. We should acknowledge that. Coming up next, it's been exactly 6 months since the Israel-Hamas war began, with more than 33,000 killed, including more than 10,000 children, and more than 100 hostages still being held captive. Stay with us.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for up to half the cost. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Savings based on cost of Consumer Cellular single line 1, 5, and 10 gig data plans with unlimited talk and text compared to lowest cost single line postpaid unlimited talk, text, and data plans offered by T-Mobile and Verizon January 2024.
You can live out your MasterChef dream when you find a professional on Angie to tackle your dream kitchen remodel. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.
Sunday marked 6 months since the Hamas attack on Israel, where more than 1,200 people were killed and more than 250, mainly from the liberal kibbutzes in southern Israel, were kidnapped. After the initial shock over that devastating event, we've learned some pretty shocking details about Israel's security failures, including that Israel's military was aware of a Hamas battle plan for an invasion for more than a year in advance. But Israeli military and intelligence officials dismissed the plan as aspirational, considering it too difficult for Hamas to pull off. We've also learned that warnings from several women soldiers serving as spotters were ignored, including preparations near the border fence, drone activity, and efforts to knock out cameras. And the Israeli death toll was revised down to 1,200 from 1,400 a month after the Hamas attack, with no real explanation. But we did learn that the attack hit not just the kids at that music festival and the kibbutzim, but also an Israeli military base and a police station. There's also the fact that the initial attack by Hamas lasted for 9 hours as civilians and soldiers alike waited for help or defended themselves. Now, 6 months later, the Israeli government finds itself in a place it likely didn't expect on October 8th, facing global condemnation for its military response in Gaza. An offensive that's killed more than 33,000 Palestinians, according to Gaza's health ministry, including more than 10,000 children, while leaving most of Gaza's 2.3 million people homeless in a sea of rubble and at risk of famine and disease. South Africa filed an unprecedented case against Israel in The Hague, charging war crimes and genocide. And young people on social media and activists on the ground in the U.S. and throughout Europe have risen up against the Gaza attack, amid the death and devastation. But pressure also continues to mount inside Israel against Prime Minister Netanyahu. Thousands of demonstrators took to the streets in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv yet again this past weekend, calling for fresh elections and demanding that the Israeli government prioritize freeing the more than 130 hostages still unaccounted for in Gaza. Meanwhile, a new round of ceasefire negotiations and hostage talks were held in Cairo without any breakthroughs. And Palestinians began returning to Khan Yunis in southern Gaza after Israel's military withdrew some ground troops there. Even as Netanyahu confirmed today that Israel plans to go ahead with an offensive in the city of Rafah, the last refuge in the south for Palestinians. Netanyahu says victory over Hamas requires it and that the date is set for the mission to begin. Joining me now is Peter Beinart, editor-at-large of Jewish Currents, author of the Beinart Notebook on Substack, and an MSNBC political analyst. Peter, assess for me where you believe Israel stands 6 months after the initial Hamas attack.
Well, Israel remains deeply, deeply divided at home, with a government that is considered illegitimate by most of its citizens. And it has destroyed a lot of Hamas's military capability. But in so doing, it is so devastated Gaza that I believe, and I really, it terrifies me to say this, but I think it's true. It has laid the groundwork for more dangerous Palestinian violence in the future. because it has left so many people devastated with their families killed or starving. And whether it's called Hamas or whether it's called something else, unless it radically changes path and offers Palestinians a path to freedom, there will be more dangers against Israel in the future.
Let me play Jose Andres, because I think the killing of those World Central Kitchen workers, it also changed something fundamentally, because it brought Europe to the table, and Australia, because their nationals were among those killed. Take a listen.
This is not anymore about the seven men and women of World Central Kitchen that perished on this unfortunate event. This is happening way for too long. It's been 6 months of targeting anything that seems moves. This doesn't seem a war against terror. This doesn't seem anymore a war about defending Israel. This really, at this point, seems it's a war against humanity itself.
And we know Jose Andres is one of the most greatest, one of the greatest humanitarians in the world. He doesn't say that lightly. We know of other incidents, a doctor from Medecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, their home being bombed in the past, two previous incidents involving World Central Kitchen itself. And I just want to show Al Shifa Hospital that became the subject of a lot of consternation about whether or not there were tunnels underneath that needed to be dealt with. But this is it now. There are no hospitals left. There are only 10 of 36 hospitals even partially functional in Gaza. The devastation, the starvation, the reputational harm, South Africa filing a genocide claim. It feels like Israel has done itself no favors reputationally.
That's certainly true. And you see in the United States that the question of conditioning military aid, which was really off the table before this war, only a very small number of Democrats in Congress supported it, has now become the mainstream position in the Democratic Party. And this is the sign of a country. Look, and this is, we can understand this, because in some ways that mood is not so different than the mood inside the United States after September 11th. A country that has tremendous military power and used that military power to lash out because of its enormous pain and agony, and we should also add humiliation, without any political strategy. The Palestinians are Israelis' neighbors. In the long run, unless Palestinians are safe, Israeli Jews will not be safe. And Palestinians cannot be safe unless they have their freedom, unless they have basic rights. And unless you show Palestinians that an ethical struggle for freedom, a struggle for freedom that respects the preciousness of all life, including Israeli life, unless you show that such a struggle has a chance of success, you are empowering the kind of evil that Hamas did when it went door to door and killed civilians on October 7th. I fear that political lesson has still not been learned.
Yeah. Peter Beinart, always a pleasure. You're always so helpful in making this all make sense. Thank you very much, my friend. Appreciate you being here. And coming up for more world events and how they affect us, be sure to check out the Readout blog and watch my conversation with Africa analyst Professor Angela Pashayan on what the rise of the global South means for the U.S. Up next, how the rhetoric surrounding the women's NCAA championship perfectly encapsulates the story of America. We'll be right back. Over the weekend, there was absolute euphoria among the newly converted legions of women's college basketball fans as the undefeated University of South Carolina Lady Gamecocks won the NCAA National Championship, powered by some dominant freshmen, giving head coach Dawn Staley her third championship as coach and making her the only Black head coach in college basketball to lead an undefeated team. South Carolina beat Iowa and its big star, Caitlin Clark, who will close out her college career with a slew of records, but no national championship ring. As with all things in America, the road to Sunday's championship had the usual political and racial subtext in the lead up to the game, driven in large part by Iowa's rivalry with the team that beat them for the title last year, Louisiana State, and Caitlin Clark's supposed rivalry with LSU star Angel Reese, a Black woman who caught all sorts of flack last year for trash-talking Clark, even as Clark's own trash-talking was celebrated as just part of her legendary behavior as the biggest star in women's hoops. And while there's no actual beef between the two women who are friendly off the court, the instinct to create racial drama and make Angel Reese the villain and Caitlin Clark the great white hope was just too juicy for the right wing and the sports media world to pass up. It's made the two women the Gen Z women's Larry Bird and Magic Johnson,
something you're sure to hear a lot more about next year when both Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese enter the WNBA draft. As for South Carolina, the players who will be back next year, a lot of fans are ready to give them and their now legendary coach Dawn Staley dynasty status. Jemele Hill joins me next.
I'm so incredibly happy for our players. It doesn't always end like you want it to end, much like last year. But my freshies are at the top of my heart because they wanted this. And I hope we can erase whatever pain they had last year experiencing not being able to finish it here. So I'm just super proud of where I work. I'm super proud of our fans.
Joining me now is Jemele Hill, contributing writer for The Atlantic and host of the Jemele Hill is Unbothered podcast. I've been on that. Jemele, okay, break down for me the legend that is Dawn Staley. I am one of those new converts. I had to point to myself when I said the people who jumped on a bandwagon, I'm on a bandwagon. Tell me about her legend.
So I'll give full credit where it's due. I heard another analyst say this, but I think it's actually true. I think she is probably in the category of the most successful player turned coach that we've ever seen, only from this standpoint. Like, if you know about Dawn Staley's resume as a player, I mean, she was a multiple winner of National Player of the Year. She also made a Final Four. In fact, I believe she is the only player who was ever voted most outstanding player during the Final Four who did not actually win the championship. So we know about her legacy as a player, the Olympic gold medals, what she's done for the game. And now for her to have a coaching resume that may be better than hers as a player, that's saying a lot. I mean, yeah, here she is with her third national title, putting herself in very rare air for all coaches. She's only the 10th program to go to complete an undefeated season. I mean,
Uh-oh, did the gremlins get Jemele? Uh-oh, we lost her. We lost Jemele. Oh, no, oh, no, oh, no. We're going to still try to get her back. Well, I will just say, well, we're trying to get Jemele Hills back. Oh, do we have her on the phone? Okay, we have her on the phone. We got you back, Jemele.
I'm going to let you,
finish your thought. Or not. Okay, we don't have her. We don't have her. Oh, there you go. I got you back. Finish your thought.
Yeah. Okay, so we're talking about her legacy as a coach. I mean, she's only, you know, she's spearheading the 10th program to go undefeated. And that is a monumental thing to accomplish in this sport. I mean, there's only a few coaches who have been able to win multiple national championships. When you think about where South Carolina was when the program started to where it is now, she has built a dynasty and a powerhouse and a premier program and in a sport where it was Tennessee, UConn for a while and nobody else. There have been other names. For her to have South Carolina in this position is a testament to who she is as a leader and as a coach.
And yet, Jemele, because, you know, I cannot bring Jemele Hill is Unbothered on here and not get into a little bit of the controversy. I was listening to this game on SiriusXM, and it seemed to me that the commentators were like a little sad that the whole storyline that they were getting to tell was about this team of freshmen and about this incredible coach and not about Caitlin Clark. They've created this sort of legend that Caitlin Clark is the entirety of women's basketball and that nothing else matters but Caitlin Clark. And no disrespect to Caitlin Clark. She's obviously a great player, but she doesn't have a ring. You know, Angel Reese has a ring, but she's the bad guy. They're making them rivals. Talk about this sort of controversy that was thrown in to the mix.
Well, the media framing has in some ways been disappointing. Yes, absolutely. Caitlin Clark should get an incredible amount of attention when you look at her being potentially the best offensive player that we've ever seen at the women's college level. Certainly, she's had one of the greatest seasons in women's college basketball, period. But the other side of this, too, and this is backed up by data and research, is that overall, in general, there is a lot of research that points to the fact that typically in this sport, that white players are marketed, branded and positioned in a different way that is much different and much higher than a lot of black players are. The WNBA is where one of these case studies happen. And so we sort of see this playing out in real time. Again, she should get a lot of attention but there's also an entire league that needs to be covered. And I know that it angered a lot of fans because I saw them on social media commenting with how when Caitlin Clark left the court, they cut away from South Carolina celebrating. The cameras were literally following Caitlin Clark into the locker room. And a lot of people, they saw a lot of the headlines today. They made sure to mention Caitlin Clark in every headline that had to do with South Carolina. When you go on social media on Instagram, you saw a lot of, you know, sports highlight type of accounts.
I think we have lost Jemele Hill again. And I will just end by saying Dawn Staley also had one of the epic swigs of water shutting down OutKick and attempting to drag trans athletes into the whole mess. But she was unbothered, as Jemele Hill is, and didn't let that happen. Jemele Hill, thank you. And that is tonight's readout.
You can start your day off right when you find a professional on Angie to get your plumbing right first. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.